Today, on Rainbow Country, the 17th annual Indie Week, recording artist, Tarouz, and Ford v. Ferrari. Stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio Toronto style right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Everyone, and welcome to Rainbow Country, as I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country, I'm Mark Tara. So, do you have an interesting story to share? Maybe you have an upcoming project that you want some airtime for. Well, get in touch and I will have you on the show. On social media, at Mark Tara Music. My email, mark@marktara.com. So, as you know, Rainbow Country is a two-hour radio show with the second hour featuring music from independent recording artists. Well, now I am curating the official Rainbow Country playlist on Spotify. So, if you are on Spotify, just search Rainbow Country episode 176 for this week's official playlist. So my friends, CIUT's fall membership drive is on. If you enjoy what we do here at CIUT, if you enjoy what we do here on Rainbow Country, I hope you will consider making a donation to the station. Donations of $25 or more automatically get a charity tax receipt. For more information, go to CIUT.fm. This is episode 176. Today, film and music. Whenever I cover an event, a festival, whatever it is, I always try to find the LGBT aspect of that event. Indie Week is no exception. I'm going to be doing interviews with artists that are part of the LGBT community that are going to be part of 2019's Indie Week. Those interviews I'll be airing at a later date. But on this episode, we'll hear from Daryl Herz, the founder of Indie Week. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of catching up with Tarouz, an independent recording artist from Montreal. We'll find out about his music, his sound, his new single, Outstanding, and more. But up first, Ford v. Ferrari, opening Friday, November 15th. During TIFF 2019, I got to catch up with Academy Award-winning stunt coordinator Robert Nagel, who talks about his work on Ford v. Ferrari.
How long have we known each other, Ken? I ever break a promise to you? I will put you in the driver's seat at Le Mans. You just shut your mouth and let me do my thing. All right.
Come here. Morning, Shelby.
Morning, Molly.
My pupils.
I'll go to hell.
That's it, folks. Ferrari wins the 24 Hours of Le Mans for the fifth consecutive year.
Mr. Ford, Ferrari has a message for you, sir.
What did he say?
He said Ford makes ugly little cars in ugly factories. And he called you fat, sir.
We're going to bury Ferrari at Le Mans.
So the great Carroll Shelby
is going to build a car to beat Ferrari.
With a Ford.
Correct. And how long did you tell them you needed? 200 or 300 years?
90 days.
Ford hates guys like us because we're different.
We heard he's difficult.
Ken? No, Ken's a puppy dog.
It's awful. There's a problem. The computer will find it.
Get some Scotch tape and a ball of wool.
What are they doing?
Making your car faster.
Oh! That's more like it!
10 miles is not a Ford, man.
We're on the verge of something, and now you tell me that I can't have the best man in the world behind the wheel?
Give me one reason why I don't fire everyone, starting with you.
Well, sir, we're lighter, we're faster. So nice. And that don't work, we're nastier.
Go ahead, Carol. Go to war.
You got a plan?
It's high risk.
I thought the whole point was to win the damned race.
If this were a beauty pageant, we just lost.
Looks aren't everything.
He is arguably one of the top working professionals in Hollywood right now. He is Academy Award-winning stunt coordinator. He is Robert Nagel. Hi.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
Fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. So let's start here with Ford v. Ferrari. You are the stunt coordinator for this film. I'm interested to know, have you seen the final version of the film?
I don't think I've seen the absolute final. I've seen two versions of it. And the last version I had seen, there were still a couple pieces that needed to be smoothed out. But I believe the version I've seen is 99.9% of the version that is currently playing.
Understood. So, Mr. Nagel, I have seen the film, and I have to say, I have some issues. Do you want to hear my issues?
Sure, why not?
Okay, first of all, I saw the film, I laughed, I cried twice, and I ruined my makeup. Okay, those are my...
I did my job.
Those are my issues. I loved the film.
I love to hear that. It was everybody was very invested in the film, and I think it shows. And to hear what you just said, I think proves that. And that's fantastic to hear.
What drew you to this particular project? Why this project?
I come from the racing world. And the GT40 has always been sort of an amazing vehicle, and the story that goes behind it, I think, is amazing. And it's a conceptual design, that vehicle, that holds true today. And for it to have been born in that era and it still hold up today is pretty amazing. And the lengths that Ford went through to develop that vehicle is pretty astounding. And then to know more detail into that story, once I got to know the real story, was, the layers involved were just, it's quite a story.
Before you came on board this project, did you know of this story originally?
I did. I don't know if not everybody knows, but originally Michael Mann had been involved in it. And I'd gotten more in-depth knowledge at that point. And then the project kind of went away. So when it came back around and I sat down with James Mangold, I already knew quite a bit of the project, and it had changed a little bit. And I knew all the ins and outs of it to start with. So it's always been something that I've been passionate, hoping that it would come back around.
So, like I said before, I saw the film. I love the film. And for me, it's an ensemble cast. But part of that cast are the racing scenes. Incredible.
Yes. And I always imagined is that, you know, the cars themselves are sort of another character as well.
So talk to me about that process. At what point do you, as a stunt coordinator, come onto this project and start coming up with ideas, concept for the stunts? At what point does that happen in the filmmaking process, especially for this project?
I mean, they're all a little different. For this particular one, early on, James allowed me and Darren Prescott, who was the second unit director, to really come up with the race sequences and all the action sequences. There were some already pieces to some of these races that we had to adhere to, but the storyline for each race I was able to develop and design so that it was very cohesive and had a rhythm to it and had a story to each race that kind of would keep you engaged, if that makes sense.
And I understand that you trained Christian Bale in the driving process?
I did. And he's hands down the best actor I've ever trained. And I've trained numerous actors in driving. And he is just absolutely amazing. Very, you know, he certainly has the aptitude for it. And there's just, there's a level and a methodology, level of focus and a methodology that goes behind driving cars like this. And he was able to apply that very, very well.
In watching the film, I loved the racing scenes, especially when there were quick edits between you're seeing his foot hitting the pedals and switching the gears. And I found myself saying, not yet, not yet, not yet. And so in the film, the Matt Damon character talks about breaking a finger. And I understand that you broke your thumb doing a Sprint NASCAR commercial, like back in the day?
I did, yeah.
So is that the only injury that you've had during your professional career?
I mean, it's the only, I'm going to say substantial injury. There's a cumulative injuries when you start crashing cars that happen, but that was the only instant injury, if you will, during a wreck that we did. But there's a cumulative injuries, you know, that show up later on in life.
So you mentioned earlier you have a background in car racing. How did you get into that profession in the first place?
You know, even as a child, I'd always been drawn to speed, whether it was, you know, riding a big wheel as fast as I could or a bicycle, and then tinkering around with go-karts and eventually getting into cars. I always tried to see how fast could I make them go, which eventually led me to racing. And I started with drag racing first because it was ultimately just about how fast you could make a car go. But I got bored of it because you're racing, you know, 10 seconds at a time and sit around for a couple hours versus road racing. We raced for hours. And to me, it was a far more mentally challenging venue. And I've always described it as a chess game at 150 miles an hour.
2015, you received an Academy Award along with Alan Paddleford for technical achievement.
The Biscuit Junior was named because its earlier design, the Biscuit, was used to shoot horse racing scenes in the film Seabiscuit. It solves those problems by creating a low-profile engine that sits right underneath the actual picture car.
The innovation is the remote systems drive pod, and this allows the actors to be in the hero car with the actual driver out of sight of the cameras. Multiple camera angles capture realistic-looking driving, while the actors can focus on their job safely and without distractions.
The Biscuit Junior has been used in high-profile films, including Drive, which involved some extremely tricky stunt driving, and most recently in the Academy Award-nominated Nightcrawler. For this innovation, the Academy presents a Technical Achievement Award to Robert Nagel and Alan Paddleford. Gentlemen, unbuckle your seatbelts and come on up to the stage.
Hi, I'm Alan Padelford, and this is Robert Nagel. And I'd like to thank the Academy for bestowing this most prestigious award to Robert and I. I would also like to thank some of the great people who took the time to sing the accolades of our work that brought the attention to the Academy. And that's Roger Deakins and Robert Elswit, Ilya Popov, Matt Sweeney, Darren Prescott. And in addition, many thanks to Gary Ross and Les Tomita for having faith in our idea for the original movie that we used it for, which was Seabiscuit. And last, but most certainly most importantly, thanks to our wives, Robin and Shannon, for their support in this crazy business, crazy, crazy business. My sons, Kyle and Riley, who are headed for the same business. Our dedicated crew at Allen Padelford Camera Cars, who build the vehicles and maintain them. And, of course, all the hardworking men and women of our extended film industry who've been a fan and supported us for all these years. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In a nutshell, you invented this apparatus. Talk to me about what the Biscuit Jr. is and what it does.
So at its basic level, it's a drivable platform that we can put, generally speaking, a car on, and you can put the actor in the car, and it allows you to be inside the car and look almost, not quite 360 degrees inside the vehicle while the actor looks like the actor is driving. And we can drive this thing at speed. And we used it quite a bit in the Ford Ferrari film, a little bit of a modified version, in that we could actually be outside the car and look down the side of the vehicle that Christian was driving and see the ground and bring cars up next to him, almost wheel to wheel, and really get you in the middle of the race. And we were running at speed, 130, 140 miles an hour with Christian in that rig.
That's incredible. So let's stay on let's stay on your Academy Award for a hot minute. Did you know that ahead of time you were going to get that award?
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, yeah. When we built the thing, no, that was never in mind. But there comes a time when somebody goes, you really should send this to the Academy and have them look at it. And we kind of hummed and hawed and said, oh, sure, yeah, whatever. Yeah, didn't think much of it. And the Academy, they just went nuts over it. They just thought it was amazing.
So when they called your name and you went up on stage, what was going through your mind?
It's a bit surreal. I mean, there's a lot to take in. It was quite an evening, and there's a lot of other award recipients, and it's kind of a blur to me, to be honest.
Do you think it's important that stunt coordinators get recognized by the Academy Awards?
I really do. I mean, you look at all the other categories that are recognized, and I mean, we put a lot of thought and heart and soul into the action pieces we do, and by the way, try and keep everybody safe and try and make it look as exciting as possible. And I think it, especially when it's something that helps drive the narrative of the story, is really an integral part of the movie. And I absolutely feel that we should be part of that.
So over the past 4 years, Mr. Robert Nagel, you have worked on about 29 productions that together have grossed worldwide over $9 billion, $9 billion. Knowing those statistics, what goes through your mind?
That's a number I can't even wrap my head around, to be honest. It's a big number.
And you've been part of that.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate. I kind of keep my head down and press forward with what I do. And just do the best I can.
So what's coming up next for Robert Nagel?
Nothing definitive yet. hopefully this film gets me to the next level. I would love to start directing second unit, which is the action pieces, and that's kind of where I'm pressing for from here.
Three quick questions. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
Okay. Red or white?
Red.
Day or night?
Right now, day.
Ford or Ferrari?
See, that's a tough one. I love them both. I don't know that I could pick one, and I love them for different reasons.
Robert Nagel, thank you so much for your time, and congratulations on a great, entertaining film. Well done.
Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate it. And I love hearing that you enjoyed the film to that level. That really makes all the hard work worthwhile. And I greatly, greatly appreciate it and appreciate speaking with you.
Oh, you're more than welcome. And I ruined my makeup. What more can you ask for?
That's why I said it. I guess I did my job.
Thanks again.
Take care. Thank you.
How long we've known each other, Ken? I ever break a promise to you? I will put you in the driver's seat at Le Mans. You just shut your mouth and let me do my thing. All right.
Come here. Morning, Shelby.
Morning, Molly.
My pupils.
I'll go to hell.
That's it, folks. Ferrari wins the 24 Hours of Le Mans for the fifth consecutive year.
Mr. Ford, Ferrari has a message for you, sir.
What did he say?
He said Ford makes ugly little cars in ugly factories. And he called you fat, sir. We're going to bury Ferrari at Le Mans.
So the great Carroll Shelby is going to build a car to beat Ferrari. With a Ford.
Correct.
And how long did you tell them you needed? 200 or 300 years?
90 days.
Ford hates guys like us because we're different.
We heard he's difficult.
Ken?
No, Ken's a puppy dog.
It's awful. There's a problem. The computer will find it.
Get some Scotch tape and a ball of wool.
What are they doing?
Making your car faster.
Oh! That's for walking!
10 miles is not a Ford, man.
We're on the verge of something. And now you tell me that I can't have the best man in the world behind the wheel?
Give me one reason why I don't fire everyone starting with you.
Well, sir, we're lighter, we're faster.
So nice.
And that don't work, we're nastier.
Go ahead, Carol. Go to war.
You got a plan?
It's high risk.
I thought the whole point was to win the damned race.
If this were a beauty pageant, we just lost.
Looks aren't everything.
My name is Charles Officer, and I'm the writer and director of Invisible Essence, The Little Prince. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Four years, 20 plus movies, over $9 billion. Robert Nagel, well done. Ford v. Ferrari opens Friday, November the 15th. From Cairo to Montreal. A few weeks ago, I caught up with Montreal-based recording artist Tarouz to talk about his current single, Outstanding, and more. So he's a singer. He's a songwriter. He is an illustrator.
Yeah,
he's
by trade.
He's a recording artist. Originally born in Cairo, came to Montreal in 2008. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Teruz, hi.
Hello. Hi.
Thank you
for having me. I'm pretty excited to do this. Thank you.
First of all, you say your name correctly for me.
Teruz.
Okay, that sounds way better than me.
When I was designing the logo, I thought, should I put an accent in French? We call it an accent aigu. Should I do it? But it's just going to alienate a lot of people.
That would be good. You know why? Because Michael Bublé, otherwise it's Michael Bubble.
Or Bubble.
You know? You have your current single and music video, Outstanding.
Yes,
talk
sir.
To me about this song, Outstanding. What is this song about?
The song is about so many things. I don't know where to put my finger on anymore. It's really about my reinvention. I used to have a folk rock band.
Mm-hmm. And, The Rising Few.
Mm-hmm. That was going pretty well. We won a couple of awards. We did the festival run, we did the showcase run, and
you were on Global TV in Montreal.
Yeah, that was a pretty good one.
You performed live acoustically.
How
was that?
This was the end of the cycle. Mm-hmm. Around that time of mm-hmm. The Rising Few, mm-hmm. and now you see me as Teruz, and with my first single, Outstanding, that I'm very proud of.
What is the song about?
The song is about really rising up to the occasion. Like it's just a sin. You can say that in so many ways, but while I was going through a lot of healing from my dad who passed away, and I decided I'm gonna restart fresh completely, and I'm gonna just work on myself until everything else falls into place. So I would go on like manic runs up the Mont Royal where I live, and at that point all I wanted to hear music wise was something with groove and something with beat. I don't know if anybody over 35 can relate, but we don't care about anything else but just to dance at that point. I don't want any lyrics that I'm not trying to be Dylan. I just want something that grooves, something to dance to, something up tempo, and that would make me happy. And I started writing from the bass, and Outstanding is totally about taking that hit and getting back up again over and over again.
It's very retro in sound, very 80s inspired, 90s inspired. It reminds me of an 80s, 90s feel, especially when it comes to like some indie groups like Chalk Circle that used to be around in Canada, and the Northern Pike.
Yeah.
Those sort of sounds. Talk to me about that influence in regards to the sound of Outstanding and your references to 80s and 90s music.
Totally. While you mentioned some very important bands, but back in Cairo, around the same time, we were getting a different batch of bands. And I was five, and my mom would strap me at the back of the car where she does her chores in Cairo. And she had one cassette with six songs playing. All six songs, like a combination of artists between Alan Parsons Project, Cat Stevens, the Bee Gees, Modern Talking, and Aphrodite's Child, if anybody remembers Aphrodite's Child. And these were the songs that I was assimilating day after day after day, and it was the perfect mix between pop and songwriting and storytelling, and even a little bit of electronic from Alan Parsons Project. They were really onto that, and that formed my taste growing up. And but Outstanding, all I tried to bring these colors and these tastes into a beat that that can be that can go with workout, that can go with I was really writing as I was running.
There's a music video, great music video in black and white.
Yeah.
The theme of the music video is boxing, and you're in the ring, maybe like the ring announcer kind of thing. Well done. Why boxing, though?
These were really the flashing images I was having in my mind as I was doing these runs and writing the song to the BPM of my own run, which is 127. And I had flashes from like Rocky montages or random fighters. It's just really the fight. It's really, and what's classier fighting than, or gentleman's fight than boxing? I just really related to these images of not necessarily boxing, but really getting knocked down. So the most legit way to get knocked down is probably by a better opponent than a boxing ring.
So you're mentioning earlier your past project, The Rising Few. You guys had two records out, 2014, Sinners on Saint, and 2017's Adult Entertainment.
Yes.
You guys were on tour. You guys were on global TV in Montreal performing live. Why did you decide to end that project?
It's a very practical decision, and any band leader would understand that you come to a certain peak with your band where you need to tour more extensively. And at a certain age, the musicians, you didn't grow up with these musicians in a garage. These are hired musicians. Okay. And to get these tours and to accept certain opportunities that come your way, you must be mobile no matter what. You must take it. But if you are dragging around musicians that are very hard to pin down availability-wise and that are... and then the gamble, the grand gamble for to get the money to go do these tours is not always as guaranteed as other bands may think it is, and so it's just harder. So switching to electronic makes the whole thing, eliminates all this, and suddenly gives you a light at the end of the tunnel for your project, because the only way you're going to push your project is if you're going to keep going forward and playing every single opportunity you can get and not really depend on somebody else's time or availability, or even if there are subs to all of them, but you need to be able to present and give the same impact that you have in your audio as you can give it live on stage, and you need to give it live on stage a lot. And with electronic music, I can either bring my whole quartet or or quintet with me, or I can just throw a laptop and a mic and a keyboard, and a car, and do all this with backing tracks on Ableton, and I will totally fulfill these targets.
So, do you have a record coming out?
I have an EP coming out by April, May.
Okay.
And I'm planning to promote that by going to by finally fulfilling that tour that I missed out on the first time around, by going to the Middle East and going to Egypt and going to Dubai and going to Jordan and hopefully Lebanon if it's not still on fire right now, and try to go claim that fame that is probably easier for me to go get there than to play here in Canada for a while, since I am from there.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Is this current single playing there right now?
This current single is currently playing internationally, yes.
And how is it doing?
People are really surprised by the quality of it, I feel. I feel that the more I release songs, the more I write songs, the more I keep pushing there, the more I hit a level that wasn't really hit by anybody else doing exactly that from the Middle East in an alternative rock scene. Mm. Maybe Carl Wolf with pop and from Lebanon, maybe a lot of rappers and hip hop, but not really in the English songwriting, folk based or alternative rooted electronic music. Nobody.
You moved to
Montreal.
To Montreal from Cairo in 2008. Mm-hmm. Why did you make that move?
Because I couldn't live my life there, my artistic life.
Okay.
The way I wanted to be able to grow and become an English singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. The habitat there was not my habitat. Although life was great for me, I had a great job as an artist. Still, it was always my trade as an illustrator, as a visual artist. Mm-hmm. I had a great job, I had everything going for me, but it hit a peak and you're still not fulfilled, you're still not satisfied. And doesn't mean that you're good at something, doesn't mean that it is what you will be doing. So all these questions come hit you like you, I don't. I'm sure a lot of people can relate when you like are getting ahead in something, but you yourself as a young man or as a young girl you're not really feeling your age. Like you, I felt I was 25, but still in the body of a 22-year-old. I needed to assimilate life in a certain way to grow as a young man, to grow as an artist, and it wasn't happening there for me. I needed to live my artistic lifestyle in the Western way and not in the Oriental way.
And why Canada, though?
Because Canada, first of all, it's a practical, totally practical decision. I already had my citizenship. So come here, get a job, get a place. From the second month, I'm already saving. I'm good. I'm already on it.
Okay.
Of course, we all had dreams of bigger cities, especially quand je parle français parfaitement, when I speak French easily. We could have went to Paris, New York, and all these. But Canada, the there's something about this big hospital, man, that you still need to, like, that's what I say. It's one big hospital. It gives a chance for everybody to come work on themselves, okay, or work on whatever trauma they had from a financial, like, I'm talking specifically about third world immigrants and second world immigrants, where you can, where either there was a war or an economic crisis or just whatever, you know, you come here and you get to heal from all this and you get to work on yourself, mm-hmm, from all this. So wherever I went, I was gonna end up doing what I'm doing here, but doing it here is closer to the heart, since I lived here when I was from the age of 8 till 12 when my dad came here and got us that citizenship.
Okay, okay. So, do you have a title for your EP?
It's my first self-entitled EP.
Okay.
So, Teruz, okay, 4 tracks, including Outstanding.
And the first single, Outstanding, is that indicative of the sound?
100%. This is the leader. This is the song.
So if people like this and the sound of
they're
going to
be
genre.
Surprised by this, because you already pick up, like you said, a lot of influences off that track, mm-hmm, but there's still a huge pool of influences within the same genre that you would be very happy to find in other songs, like Joy Division, like Interpol, like
any Middle
Alan
Eastern
Parson
flavors too.
I thought about it a lot, mm-hmm, not musically, but maybe vocally.
Okay.
Lyrically.
And how would you describe your sound vocally? Because you have a very unique sound.
I feel if I wasn't doing this, I would probably be doing hypnosis.
Okay.
I know, it's pretty piercing.
Because you have a deeper sound, deeper voice.
Yeah. And it's just...
References to like what, Bowie, that sort of thing?
I would say Editors. It's an English band, and I fell upon them in the... not only Editors, there's also Madonna. There's also Madonna who would switch to this tone in the middle of a song and then come back to her soft. And I really always related to that. But anyway, just reinventing myself and coming up with this song, it felt like this is the right tone that I want to sing with. And it's also the right tone I want to talk in. It just makes me very comfortable and it comes out naturally. And I'm happy I'm done with paying homage to my folk rock idols and heroes. That's behind me with The Rising Few.
Okay.
Now it's that's why I recalled this project Teruz, because now I feel it's more me than ever.
Right. So if people want to find out more about Teruz, your upcoming EP, how can they do that?
Teruz is TERROUZ. Mm-hmm. If you put that on Facebook, you find me. Put that on Spotify, you follow me. Put that on YouTube, you can subscribe. And there's also the website, teruz.com. So you have every little area to go.
3 quick questions.
Sure.
Are you ready?
Shoot.
Red or white?
White.
Day or night?
Night.
Cairo or Montreal?
Can't be one without the other. There cannot be. It's like the yin yang. It's like that sign.
Both.
Yeah. It's got to be both.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time.
You're most welcome. Merci beaucoup. Toronto. I'm recording artist Terus. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
His current single, Outstanding, is out now. Indie Week, a music festival and conference, runs November 13th to the 17th. I recently caught up with the founder of Indie Week, Daryl Hurst, to find out what music fans can expect from this year's festival. Daryl Hurst, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
We're getting down to the crunch. I'm super excited. The festival this year is looking like it's going to be our best one yet.
Mm-hmm. Indie Week runs November 13th to the 17th. You started this almost 20 years ago. This is what, your 17th year?
17th year, yeah.
In 2019, what can people expect from Indie Week 2019?
One change is we're one day less, but we are packing more stuff within the days we've got. We've got an Indigenous focus a whole afternoon. We have panel discussions, talk about Indigenous music communities and how the industry, the music industry, can connect with them. Plus, we have an Indigenous showcase that night featuring Kelly Fraser, Juno-nominated artist that is amazing. We've also have included all ages shows, so we've never done that before. We wanted to connect with the youth. I feel the music industry has sort of changed, and I think it's harder for young up-and-coming artists to gain contacts or get to know about the business, even though we have all this tech stuff around where you could just Google it. There's less and less things like record stores and music stores and all that kind of stuff where young artists can connect. So we have a whole focus on young artists with showcases that we partnered with is Youth Jam and Youth Event Showcases. So we've got two partners within that community, which is great. We've got music buyer showcases. So we're actually flying in and bringing in agents, bookers, buyers, festival bookers and programmers with the specific intent of booking artists or looking for artists that they can program at their events. All that's happening, plus a three-day conference. We have a big focus on Korea. Indie Week was selected, and we are the only festival they selected for this new program called Korea Splash. So myself and one of our programmers flew to Korea, and they put together a showcase specifically for us. We met with seven artists, and we were able to select two artists, and they're bringing them over to showcase. And through our talks, they added a third.
And is that because last year you took a Korean group to Brazil?
That's part of it. That's so we had a last year a Best of the Fest, which is like the artists are selected, voted on, and we award the Best of the Fest. And that allows us to give recognition to an artist that we think should go to the next level. They get a lot of media around it and exposure and all that kind of stuff. Usually everybody hates that word exposure, but it's true when you have like 20 cameras pointed at you and posting on social. But yeah, we took them to Brazil in August this year, which already feels like last year, but it was this year. So they had a great response. They played in front of over 5,000 people on the main stage, one of the main stages, and it was great. So we're looking to keep continuing with that type of program. We are also talking with Coma Fest on bringing one of their programmers with the specific intent to select a Toronto artist. We did also have Toronto's Sate play at Coma Fest this year. So we're building that international connection. So Southeast Asia with Korea, we've got South America with Brazil. We're also doing some a showcase that's going to feature ATX6 from Austin, Texas. So Toronto has always been talking about this connection to Austin. Well, we're just doing it. This will be the third time hosting ATX6. But we're also in talks on how do we bridge that gap between Toronto and Austin. A lot of international focus this year. So less days, one less day, but crazy amount of stuff in that time.
Sounds like it. So the music conference aspect, ultimately, what are you hoping that artists will come away with from the music conference aspect of Indie Week?
Right. Well, the industry has changed so much from when I played and also when we started this whole thing. Like, it's almost as if a lot of the industry is broken down and another part is built up. It's almost like the middle class is disappearing. It's just like the rest of the world. Touring artists are doing great. Local artists, not as much, possibly. I hear a lot of indie artists saying it's hard to bring out people, but yet I see a touring show and it's sold out. So people do go out, but they just want to go out for the right reason. So a lot of our conference is focused on connecting indie and emerging artists with the music industry. They get to talk one-on-one in our B2B sessions, mentorships, feedback from demo listening. Our conference is called Indie 101, so it's very educational. We've got presentations on how to market, how to run a streaming ad campaign, how to do social media, like really how an artist can run their business. A big part is talking about monetization of music or lack of. It's there, but how do you get it? So we've got a lot of focus on that as well. So we're really trying to bring in the people that know the business, they're part in the business, but we want artists to connect with them and be able to ask questions and learn from it.
Inclusion, diversity, it's on everyone's mind these days.
Absolutely.
In regards to Indie Week and the artists that you have, how important is representation to Indie Week?
It's always been very important. Part of my own personal sort of thing is I find it weird that we're talking about some of the stuff in this day and age. But you see what's going on politically around the world, and it's like more prevalent than ever. It's almost like we need to almost go back a bit to go forward. And at Indie Week, we've always just programmed artists mostly on the merit of music. Like, we hear a good song, that's what we're looking for. It's a weird thing. Like, we're doing the indigenous sort of focus this year, but that started 2 years ago with us. And it was Kelly Fraser, where I remember listening to applications and this song came in, and I was like, wow, we need this artist. And it was later that I found out that she's from the North. And, the song she's actually talks about is Fight for Our Rights for Our People. And I tell this story quite often because it means a lot to me, is that Kelly came to me as Friday night at Cherry Cola's, that festival is 2 years ago. And it's after she had performed and she was like crying. And I'm like, what's wrong? And she's like, nothing. I'm just happy. And I'm like, okay, I'm just making sure she's okay, you know. And she's like, no, you just put me on a stage with other artists. Normally she's on a specific type of showcase and all this kind of stuff. And it meant the world to her that she just played as an artist. So that said a lot to me then. And we've sort of been on this path on trying to figure stuff out. And last year we had an Indigenous artist, Twin Flames. And it feels right this year. Like, I feel to do something, you got to kind of investigate and learn a bit before you just jump in. I also went to the Indigenous Music Awards earlier this year and have learned a lot from that session. Twin Flames, there's at Folk Alliance this year was a big Indigenous component, and Twin Flames has a song with UNESCO, which is unreal. So we were like, hey, two of the artists that we've worked with have actually been acknowledged by other members of the industry. So we're like, you know, and through, I also work for CD Baby. At the Indigenous Music Awards, I found out that, you know, about 60% of the nominees are distributed through CD Baby. So I've been looking into that community and how can we help them and educate and connect. And it's one step at a time. It's a learning process for everybody. But, you know, at Indie Week, we've just booked artists, you know, and I think that says a lot. You know, and there's been times where, you know, it's uneasy or you don't like, you just want to do things as best as you can the right way, especially in this day and age. Mm-hmm. So I also think that we're in a place where people are hesitating on things because they're worried about doing it the wrong way.
Right.
And the backlash that could happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm guilty at times of like getting real excited about something. Let's just do it. Let's put it together. Let's go. And learning like, oh, maybe I didn't do that the right way. Mm. Like that happens.
Yeah.
I get excited about artists. I get excited about bands. I get excited about great songs or performances.
And ultimately,
that's where I go.
Ultimately, Indie Week is about the music.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Like we've had a band called Mad Violinist and Symphony Crack Orchestra. They're from Atlanta, and we hosted them in Ireland, and they were voted best of the fest, so we flew them to Toronto. There's no singer in the band. It's a violinist, and one worst band name ever, I would say. But they were so amazing live. They ended up packing every venue, and people were freaking out over them. The music industry is like, we don't know what to do with them. The violinist went on to perform for Nicki Minaj's on her CDs and also produced. I believe he's 6-time Grammy nominated producer now, you know. So there's also other aspects of great music that's like there's a story behind it, and it's not necessarily just them being an artist. There's a songwriter, there's a producer. We've had like a lot of crazy stuff. We had a band called Mortal Kombat, which probably could get some copyright issues, but it was basically two guitarists who hooked up a PlayStation and played Mortal Kombat by playing two guitars.
Okay.
So the music, like they were fighting, but it was by playing guitar.
But they're using technology.
Yeah.
Speaking of technology.
So it's cool, right?
Well, speaking of technology, I think it's fair to say you were talking about it earlier. It's really changed.
Yeah.
You know, for better, for worse, whatever, the industry, the music industry, the film industry, TV. How has technology in 2019, how has it influenced Indie Week in 2019?
Interesting.
Is it making it easier for you guys to get the word out through social media? Because
oh, definitely.
The iPhone came about in, what, 2007? Yeah. So, and Indie Week was still going.
Yeah.
So, technology.
One, on the back end, it's allowed us to build systems in place to allow us to manage mm-hmm. volume mm-hmm. like this. On the artist selection phase, we've built our own system for artists to submit music. Mm-hmm. So it comes in a way that it organizes and it allows us to make selections a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. Getting the word out, definitely social media targeted ads. Mm-hmm.
Awareness. Are you a fan of streaming services?
Yes. Overall, 100%. We're in an age where I wish I had this stuff when I was performing. Like, you can make your own video. I don't understand why bands don't have 100 videos out because you have a phone that can do video, and you can get an app for like $20 that can edit all that you want. Why does why are there so many bands that don't have a good quality video? Because you have it in your pocket. Yeah. I don't get that. Bands, do make some videos, will you? Get it out there. That's an amazing thing. Like, I remember, man, when I played, like, you'd have to have like a camera that's the size of a shoebox, and it was like VHS, and it was crappy. You know, it's amazing that you could do really good video.
What type of band were you in?
I played in many bands, from jazz to rock to instrumental to
guitar.
Yeah, guitar. So bands should have all the promotional tools available to them. You know, streaming. If as a band member, that's like, I find people are arguing all the time about money and streaming. Well, there's a thing about music. It's like, you know, it's the new radio. Right. And the deals may be made this way or that way, but the artists, like, for now, this, until things change, don't fight it. Use it. Mm-hmm. You know, get the word out, and then use the data to know where your audience is, and then target ads to that audience, and then decide when it's right to book a show there or not. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a thing about maybe releasing not worldwide, but territory by territory, and concentrate and build an audience before you go to the other territory. I just had this talk. I was at Halifax Pop Explosion last week, and I sat in on this talk about streaming and tech. And one of the things is that, you know, the second your music is out, it's old, right? If it's 2 months, it's old. And if you're not marketing in a territory that you're releasing it to, maybe you're not doing the justice of that song. So time is always an issue. Money is always an issue. So maybe it's like, hey, I'm going to market to this territory intensely and try to build an audience, and then I'll move to the next territory. So you can do sort of timed releases and so forth. So I think we're in an age where it's like, man, sit down and plan it and then execute. And I think tech has made it so easy to just throw it out there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Without the thought behind it.
Yeah. Like, I literally had an artist not too long ago go, I'm in the studio right now. I'm finishing a track. Tomorrow it's going to be mastered. Can I release it by Tuesday? And I'm like, are you marketing it? Are you announcing it? Are you telling
people about it? Is there a video for
it? Is there a video? Anything. Yeah. Right? And I think they'll see people who already have an audience. Mm-hmm. Release it, and it's also in news and doing all that, but they already have an audience. For an artist that's trying to build an audience, it's the opposite.
Yeah. So do you think that's going to come up in the industry conference aspect of Indie Week?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, you'll touch on that.
Yeah, we've got Canadian Musician Magazine doing a talk. Okay. In fact, I was just answering an email about it, but doing a talk all about streaming. Mm-hmm. Right? And where is it in this day and age? We've got Kevin from CD Baby coming up talking about how to do a successful release. We've got two talks on social media marketing. And then we're talking to an app right now that artists, it's, think of like a Kickstarter type of thing. Not Kickstarter, kind of Kickstarter, I guess. But getting fans that can monetize you right now for future royalties and things like that. So definitely tech is a big aspect. We basically have an afternoon, Saturday, November 16th at the Thompson Hotel. Mm. For the most part, is all sort of like tech and that kind of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
You were recently named Director of Market Development Canada for CD Baby.
Yes.
CD Baby is the largest online distributor of independent music in the world. Director of Market Development Canada, what does that entail? What does that mean?
No sleep. Okay. Yeah, no, just kidding. Well, essentially, it's the bit of the backstory is I did a trip to South America 2 years ago, Chile, Argentina, Brazil. And on that trip, I'd actually met the CD Baby reps. So it's crazy to kind of like come around to that part. And then Indie Week in UK last year, we ran it. We're not this year. Brexit, staying away from it. Indie Week UK last year, CD Baby was a sponsor. And I brought in basically my now boss, up to speak, Ellie Del Moral. I had him speak at Indie Week last year, and then he messaged later saying, man, there's a lot going on in Canada. Like, we're interested in potentially having somebody on the ground there. So we got into talking, and luckily that became me. Yeah, it's an amazing company to work for. I could not be happier, and I love that working for a company with integrity. They've been around since 1998, the first ones to get independent artists on iTunes, which says a lot. Also between iTunes, Apple, YouTube, and Spotify, they're the only company that's the preferred partner for all three. So I love being a part of that. And really what we're working on is programs that can help educate artists. You know, yes, we're a distributor, but putting your music out there doesn't necessarily mean it'll be successful. So we'd like to show how to make money and monetize it and market it using our platform, really. And, you know, CD Baby also hosts a conference called DIY in Austin, Texas. I went to it. It was my first one this year. And it was such a learning experience for so many artists. There's over 1,000 artists attending.
Mm-hmm. And they stream that on YouTube.
Yeah, it's great. And we also do one in Spain in the spring, in Valencia. So a company that's so dedicated to educating artists. There's a DIY blog, a DIY podcast. It's much more than just distribution. Mm-hmm. And part of my job is to get the word out about it and let people know all the other tools that exist, mm-hmm. and also education. And also we're partnering with other festivals and conferences. I was just at Halifax Pop. Before mm-hmm. that was at Breakout West. We're doing M for Montreal. So it's pretty crazy.
Was this position created for you?
Not necessarily. Like, it's a
were they going to do this anyway?
They were basically looking into it.
Okay.
I think what helped is Ellie coming to Indie Week and then seeing, wow, we should have somebody on the ground in Canada.
Yeah.
I'm part of the international market development team. We just hired 2 people in India. We've got Southeast Asia. We've got South America. So it's a pretty cool team that I'm a part of. I'm very lucky.
Wow.
Yeah.
So a vibrant music scene promoting arts and culture draws international awareness, draws tourism.
Yes.
Draws money. Music City Strategies. Are you a fan of a city like Toronto having a music city strategy?
I think every city that is planning on having a music community that draws international, I think that they have to have some sort of plan. I think that there may be a disconnect in actually working that plan or executing it. The things that are going on is Noise City bylaws and parking and rehearsal space and, you know, venues opening and closing and venues that are willing to host all genres or race, color, anything. Mm-hmm. You know, it's also a discussion I had at Halifax Pop last week, right? Where one of the things that I have a hurdle in Toronto with often is hosting a night that has hip-hop. You know, a lot of venues don't want that. And so we're kind of pushed into a corner as to where can we host that.
Is that for safety reasons?
A number of reasons, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've worked at venues. I've been a booker at, like, a number of venues in the city.
The Rivoli, weren't you?
Rivoli, yes. Yeah. I was there for 3.5 years. And almost every venue I've worked at, the owners were all like, no hip-hop right off the bat. And so it's been a struggle as to being able to program it, and I would, you know, it's a thing that, it's funny that what's Toronto known for? Drake, right? And I think that we're missing an opportunity to really engage with that culture, and if anything, that culture is, and that genre of music is doing amazing worldwide. We could probably bring in some dollars in mm-hmm. tourism through it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as far as a Music City plan, yes.
Are you involved in any way, shape, or form?
Directly, no. Like, I've been asked to sit in on a few things, and right now my time limits doesn't really allow me to do so much. There is a noise bylaw meeting I'm going to tomorrow night. And half the time I'm not in town anymore. So that's been an issue where I haven't been able to attend everything I've wanted to. Mm-hmm. I try to be as active as I can within the community of that.
But do you think it's ultimately a good idea for a city like Toronto to have something like that?
Absolutely, but they need to act on it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been a lot of talk, and I think we're moving in the right direction. It's a hard thing when politics are involved. You know, everybody wants to move a certain way, but we have to go on the timeline that the people in office are on.
Yeah. So that can be challenging.
It is so challenging.
Frustrating, even.
Yeah, Mike Tanner, who runs the office for Toronto, does an amazing job, and he's doing the best he can, you know. And I think that we really need to applaud that. We need somebody on the inside that has a voice, that can get an ear, and start moving the needle in the right direction. And you know, Toronto has so much potential to be massive on the international scene. One, all the big stars come here no matter what. Often they come before a CD release to build awareness. Then they come tour a few months later, and then a few months later again. And that's all money coming into the city. But what I would really like to see is Canadian and Toronto artists and Ontario artists really thrive, and the scene to thrive, mm-hmm. the venues to be packed and making money. And there's ways to do that, but we all have to work together.
Yeah. Indie Week. Mm-hmm. Most challenging aspect?
Ooh, most challenging aspect. Mm-hmm. It's a fine line on not getting answers back that you need, or everybody asking for answers that you're waiting to get. Like, if you're booking 200 bands and they all email, so when are we, that's 200 emails to answer of, I'll get back to you tomorrow. And then us asking people on getting answers, like, it's a logjam of communication at times in this day and age, you know.
Best aspect of Indie Week.
Man, you meet so many amazing, great people. There's so many relationships and friendships, and this is one thing I tell artists all the time. A festival with a conference aspect to it, you could basically call it a trade show. And a festival, to me, it's in a field and a stage, and it's just music and no industry. A conference is a whole bunch of people sitting around talking about music business and blah, 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 but no festival, right? When you put the two together, it's a trade show. And artists are there to perform with the goal of trying to connect with somebody that will help them in the future. And that future may be a week, a month, a year, 2 years, you don't know. And this is the thing that I've seen happen, right? A good example right now, Sumo Psycho. Right, Sumo Psycho are on this massive tour in North America. They're doing 31 dates, opening for a band called Ginger, and most of the shows are sold out. They leave 3 weeks after that, which will be in November, to headline a tour in the UK with Live Nation. We were the ones to bring them to Ireland 5 years ago, and they hadn't been to Europe before. They really took it. They made connections, and this is what they've done with it. It's amazing to see. And the thing about a festival with a conference is attend everything you can. Make connections. Talk to people. And don't expect a thing from them. Right? They don't know you. Build friends for life if you can. For me, I've now built friends, like lifelong friends in Ireland, in the UK, in Asia, in Brazil. Like, I'm able to travel these places. I send out a text and all of a sudden I'm meeting friends, right? And for an artist, those are all allies that can help you in the business. And people always say it's hard. And I'm like, I don't know. It's easy when you've got more friends. And so To build friends and relationships, you have to be present and you have to attend and you have to participate.
Yeah.
And that's what I see so much in the artist community, which makes me sad, is like all these festivals are putting on all these events. They're flying in delegates, they're flying in industry, and they go, hey, here's a mentorship session. And like 10 people show up. And you're like, what? I don't get it. Here's this opportunity to connect with somebody who could change your career or your life. Right? And that's the thing about a music festival, the conference, is it's like a trade show. And your performance is like your booth. And the thing is, get as many people there that you can to your booth.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And that's what it is.
That's a great analogy, actually. You know?
Because I thought about it, like I sort of came up with it about a year ago, because people are always trying to compare us to like a Lollapalooza, you know, like, oh, there's tons of bands and this and that and all that. Like, where's your headliners and all that, right? And I'm like, we're about discovering new talent. And we put them on the stages. We bring in industry and delegates. This year we're bringing in a ton of bookers. And it's up to the artist to stand out, just like at a trade show. You know, I've been to so many trade shows, even South by Southwest, where, man, there's no one even attending their booth. And I just walk by. Right? So it really is in the hands of the artist to get to be known.
Yeah.
To make it where, man, I'm going to go see them. They're at this place at this time, and I'm going to mark it on my schedule to be there. Mm-hmm. That's the role of the artist. And sometimes they think it's the role of the festival. And the thing is, if you think logically, if I bring in somebody from, like, in fact, bringing in somebody from a festival in New York, and if I go, I've got 200 great acts. Can you see all 200? No. Mm-hmm. If I go, here's 20 acts, they'll be like, what's your best five? Right? So the thing is, I can't tell the delegates to see everybody.
Right.
It's up to the artist to be recognized and known, or them to make a contact for the delegates to go and see them.
Right.
And that's like a trade show.
Right.
So hopefully that helps.
I think you're spewing gold right now. Daryl Hirst, thanks for your time.
Thank you. This is great.
Hi, I'm Gordep of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Indie Week, music festival, and conference runs November 13th to the 17th. For more information, indieweek.com. Don't forget, Ford v. Ferrari opens Friday, November 15th, and Outstanding, the new single from Tarouz, is out now. Get social, get interactive on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Mark Tara Music. The podcast for Rainbow Country is on iTunes, Podomatic.com, Google Play Music, Stitcher Radio, and on Spotify. So get Rainbow Country wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And of course, everything is hooked up at my website, MarkTara.com. Next week, Transgender Day of Remembrance. Finally, I want to take this time to thank you for taking your time to be with me. Remember, we live in days of making dreams come true. So believe in yourself, and the world will believe in you.
Hi, I'm Mayor John Tory, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.